Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We know that we're facing an unprecedented number of environmental challenges right now, many of them the direct result of human activity. But focusing on the gloom and doom doesn't seem to spur a lot of action. There's a new environmental movement gaining steam. It's called Earth Optimism. Instead of focusing on the melting ice caps, species extinction, and catastrophic weather events, Earth optimists would rather focus on the forests that are growing back, the success of renewable energy, a recovering ozone layer, the giant panda no longer on the brink of extinction. And certainly any environmentalist will tell you that there's still plenty to be concerned about. But there are also reasons to be hopeful about the fate of our planet. One of the leaders of this movement is Nancy Knowlton. She is chair of marine science at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian. And she is with us on the line today. Hello, Nancy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure.
And for you, this started with the ocean. And of course, we know that there are so many challenges facing the ocean, the oceans of the world right now. When did you start thinking about trying to frame your message in a more positive way?
Well, I was teaching at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in a program that we like to think of as medical school for the ocean, training young students to be future problem solvers. And thinking about it in that context, I started to realize that in medical school, you don't train students who are going to be doctors to write obituaries of their patients. And yet I felt like what we were doing is essentially training our students to write ever more refined obituaries of the ocean, of nature in general. And you could just see it in their faces, even when we'd stand up at the beginning of a course and talk about the state of the ocean, talk about all the problems. You might not get to the solutions till weeks or sometimes even a month or so later. And it just wasn't working. And that's when I began with a project called Beyond the Obituaries, which was designed to find these success stories that were out there and talk about them. And it turns out other people around the world were having similar misgivings about a doom and gloom only focus. And so we got together and in 2014 and launched a Twitter campaign. It was pretty simple when you think about it, with a hashtag, and the hashtag was hashtag ocean optimism, and that's where this whole thing started.
Now, of course, students do need to know about the bad things. They need to know about the state of the oceans today and what's going on. So how do you, with this approach, also do your due diligence and make sure that it's a holistic approach?
Well, it is a holistic approach, and I don't think anyone who's in the thinking about ocean optimism or earth optimism is trying to downplay the seriousness of what's going on. In fact, I think essentially all of us begin with that as a premise, but it's a question of balance. If you go to a lecture about the environment or you watch, say, an environmental film, typically it's 90, 95% problem, 5% solution. And what we're trying to do is introduce the problems, but then move quickly from the problems to the examples of what's working, why it's working, and how we can scale it up.
So give me a specific example of how you might do that, a story that you might tell.
Well, there are a ton of stories from the ocean, of course, because that's where I started. And one example is this wonderful story about the recovery of puffins along the shores of Maine, and actually north of Maine in Canada. Those puffins were decimated by hunting, and the United States did pass a law back in the beginning of the 20th century to prohibit the hunting, but the puffins didn't come back. And it wasn't until a scientist named Stephen Kress started, and he's got a wonderful book, by the way, called The Puffin Project, which talks about this in great detail. And he started thinking about the fact that the puffins were probably just scared to come back to these empty rocks because there are no other puffins around. They reacted, they're social, they like to live in big groups, and they just weren't attracted to these empty rocks. So he put wooden puffins on the rocks. He played puffin songs to the puffins that were flying by, and he brought in a few baby puffins to jumpstart the process. And the result is now that there are hundreds of nesting puffins on the coast of Maine. And moreover, the method that he used is now being used for seabirds around the world. So it's just one of literally thousands of examples where we've identified a problem, figured out how to solve it, and implemented the solution.
Now, that story, it makes me smile. It makes me want to go see puffins.
Yeah, they're great.
Right. But also, what do you think that does for your students? How does that reframe their thinking? I mean, it makes them feel good, but what's the next step?
It does much more than make them feel good. First of all, I think it identifies, I mean, in this case, I'm no longer at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, but when I was teaching there, I was training scientists and scientists, broadly speaking, also social scientists, economists, things like that. But I think it makes them realize, first of all, the importance of what they're doing and the importance of having some kind of scientific basis for figuring out how to solve the problem. But it also, I think, conveys the message that if they decide to do something, they have and really work at it, they could succeed. So it empowers them, really.
Let's broaden the conversation here a little bit. I want to bring somebody else into the conversation. I'm talking with Nancy Knowlton, Chair of Marine Science at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian. I want to bring Connie Mutel into the conversation as well. Her most recent book is A Sugar Creek Chronicle, Observing Climate Change from a Midwestern Woodland. She's a senior science writer with Hydroscience and Engineering at the University of Iowa. Connie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Charity. It's nice to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And you came on the program not that long ago to talk about A Sugar Creek Chronicle, which talks about your firsthand observations of climate change. That has launched you on really a circuit of speaking about climate change, educating people about climate change. And in some ways, that's been a real challenge for you to focus on this subject. Tell me a little bit about what it's like to walk into a room full of people and give them the kind of information that you share about climate change and evidence for climate change.
Well, it's interesting. I guess thinking about it, perhaps giving a talk is similar to the process that I went through when writing the book, because it was very difficult to write that book and to keep it upbeat and positive. And I had to struggle during the writing with maintaining hope, maintaining a vision for the future, maintaining a solid belief that we had options for the future. All of those are true and all of those are good. But when I walk into especially a classroom with students, I think I enjoy my talks to students, mostly university students, the most. You walk in, and a lot of times you can see that they're uneasy, they're uncomfortable. They know what's going on with the world. They're dealing with a world that has climate change and multiple changes to its ecological and environmental processes. They see those, and they know that their future is going to be shaped by those. They don't know what to do about it. They have classes where, as Nancy said, a lot of times they're studying the problems. They might not necessarily be studying the solutions. And so a lot of times when I give talks now, what I've learned to do is to talk to the students a lot about the solutions. I do cover climate change somewhat, but then I go on to the fact that we still have options. And I try to give the students the idea that, in a way, they might not have chosen to be born at this time, but being born at this difficult time in the history of the Earth, it means that their lives really have an opportunity to make a big difference. They can make tremendous changes in the future of the world by what they decide to do and how they approach it. And then I try to give them a few tools. I talk to them about how to take care of themselves, just basic things. I say that this has to be as important as learning the material. I talk to them about how to develop and maintain hope. And I try to always end talks with the idea of developing a vision for the future so that we know where we're going. And all of those things seem to leave the students by the end of the talk more positive and energized. Like Nancy said, this is a way of empowering students, energizing students, destroying the despair that they may often feel when confronting these types of problems, climate change and other environmental problems.
Well, and the way you framed that, Nancy, I borrowed earlier in the show, I borrowed a line from you and one of your collaborators in saying that when Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech, he did not say, I have a problem. He presented a vision for a brighter future. Is that really a direct inspiration for Earth optimism?
I started thinking about it in the context of the I Have a Dream speech relatively recently, but there are lots. So I now use it because I realize that it perfectly encapsulates my less elegant way of talking about this for all these years. And in fact, it's turned out to be quite powerful. I now use that quote and that comment about the quote to end every single one of my talks. And what's amazing about it is when I have people come up to me afterwards, they always say, I mean, some of them say, I'm totally with you. I've been thinking about the limits of doom and gloom for a long time. But other people, often, in fact, scientists who work in the environment, who are overwhelmed day after day with all – they know the problems inside out. And sometimes it really can be overwhelming to be in this business. And I've had scientists come up to me and said, you know, I was a little skeptical about this whole thing. I understand there are a lot of successes, but there's so many problems. But that last slide nailed it. You're so right. And so now I use it all the time. But it wasn't actually how I started it. So I think the more I've been doing this, the more I read outside of the environment, outside of thinking more about social change in a much broader sense than just how up to get our planet to a sustainable basis. And so the more I read, the more I am inspired by other people who have accomplished amazing changes in terms of how we behave on the planet. And so I've learned from them as I go along.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Nancy Knowlton. She is chair of marine science at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian. Also with us this hour, Connie Mutel. Her most recent book is A Sugar Creek Chronicle, Observing Climate Change from Midwestern Woodland. She's a senior science writer with Hydroscience and Engineering at the University of Iowa. This hour, we're talking about a new environmental movement. It's called Earth Optimism. We'd love for you to join the conversation as well. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Earth optimism, focusing on some of the things that are going right with environmental science and the environmental movement today, instead of focusing on the gloom and doom. And there's plenty of that we could talk about. We're talking about building a vision for a brighter future. One of the leaders of this movement is Nancy Knowlton, chair of marine science at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian. Connie Mutel is also with us. Her most recent book is A Sugar Creek Chronicle, Observing Climate Change from a Midwestern Woodland. She's a senior science writer with Hydroscience and Engineering at the University of Iowa. And you are welcome to join the conversation as well. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Connie, we were talking about how you've been giving a lot of talks about climate change and evidence of climate change. I'm curious, do you feel like in some ways climate change deniers in this country have been able to force the conversation to focus on evidence as opposed to talking about what people are doing? Because there seems to be this constant struggle to prove that what most scientists agree is real is real.
Well, Charity, I haven't ever really thought about that. I guess you could say, possibly, although focusing on evidence, I think that people who are talking about climate change and studying climate change know that the evidence is overwhelming. There is no debate about both its occurrence and its cause. So I don't know if that focus needs to be honed in upon. I don't know about climate change deniers. I don't really understand where they come from, because even if they did think that this might not be true, the effects of climate change are so devastating, I don't know why they would not just go along with the possibility that maybe they should do something positive instead of talk about the non-existence of climate change.
Well, and I'm thinking more not just about conversations in classrooms or among scientists, but the popular conversation, the things that we see in the media. I mean, do you feel like maybe this idea of climate denial, Nancy, has driven the conversation too far?
Well, I think it certainly hasn't helped, because as you mentioned, the scientific consensus is overwhelming. And there has been a concerted campaign to cause doubt. There's a book actually called Merchants of Doubt, which is about that strategy of causing, you know, constantly sort of picking away at small details to undermine the confidence that people in the general public who are trying to understand this have in what is the scientific consensus. My own feeling about this is that things are changing now really fast, that so in terms of the viability of solutions for climate change, particularly in the energy market, new batteries, and I know Connie will talk a little bit probably about what's happening in Iowa, but there's a woman named Catherine Hayhoe at Texas Tech, and she talks a lot about how let go of the argument about the facts and just talk about these solutions, which are really win-win solutions for both the climate and economically for people. The huge growth in jobs, the dropping prices. I mean, there's a lot positive going on, and it's almost, I think, at the point where people who care about this issue, I mean, depending on the audience, but in some cases, it just shifts the way you frame it. Talk about the benefits and the shared values, as Catherine Hayhoe mentions, that, and you're likely to make a lot more forward progress, I think, in terms of having a real conversation. There's a town in Texas, which is a very, it's not a liberal tree-hugging town, called Georgetown, Texas. And we had a big summit called the Earth Optimism Summit, and we invited the mayor there. He's a Republican mayor, and he says, you know, our town is all renewable, and the reason it's all renewable because it makes the tax bills lower for my citizens. And I really think a lot of the discussion about climate change is going to move in that direction from here on end.
Well, and let's talk about the Earth Optimism Summit. You held the first Earth Optimism Summit ever. Was that just last spring?
Yes, it was over Earth Day weekend, 2017.
So tell me about that gathering. Who came?
Oh, well, it was incredibly diverse. About 1,500 people came. We had about 240 speakers. And we deliberately framed it very, very broadly. Now, the Smithsonian doesn't actually have professionals working in all these areas, but the idea was for us to act as a convener of all these different approaches. So we had people working relatively traditional fields, such as protecting places and conserving species. But we also had people working in engineering solutions, getting rid of ocean plastics. We had philanthropists. We had venture capitalists who were interested in financing green solutions. We had artists and musicians. We had politicians. We had members of the media. So it was an incredibly broad spectrum of attendees. And then the stories themselves also ranged from very small-scale solutions and scattered places from around the world, which had the potential to grow up, to big picture solutions being implemented by major corporations. And I think the meeting worked because there were just no one had ever attended anything where they were essentially drowning in success. There were so many successes, and because they were so diverse, any single participant probably didn't know about 90% of them. So it was this amazing experience of being surrounded by this positivity and being inspired to say, okay,
there's all this stuff that's going on. What can I do to make a difference?
Well, let's talk about a few more examples because, you know, we talked about the puffins earlier, which, again, it's so exciting to hear a story like that. And you have collected so many stories like that. So let's talk about a few more of the stories that you'd like to focus on. I know one of them is about setting up a marine protected area in Baja California.
Yes, that's a story of a small village called Cabo Pulmo. It was a very poor village of artisanal fishers, and like essentially all such villages over the last several decades, the waters had become increasingly depleted of fish because people are hungry and they were just catching what they could catch to literally put dinner on the table that night. And then the head of the village had a realization that they were on a road to nowhere for their, not only for themselves, but for their kids and their grandkids. If they didn't change the way they were doing things, they would be left with nothing. And scientists told them that what they were doing was unsustainable. Tourists told them that there wasn't really much to look at underwater because all the fish were gone. And so they set up this protected area, the Cabo Pulmo, which is now the Cabo Pulmo National Park. And in a course of 10 years, the amount of fish has increased enormously, but also the incomes of the people have increased because of all this extra money coming in from tourism. So it's been argued as the most successful marine protected area on the planet. And it's, I find it an inspirational story because these are people that got together and did something to make a better future for themselves and their families and their you know, children and grandchildren. And it's not like they have huge amounts of money behind them, pushing them, helping them. They did it because they were just determined to make a difference for themselves and the future of where they lived. And so I think it's a very inspirational story because if they can do it and have so many benefits, not just the fish, but the people who are benefiting, anybody can do this sort of thing.
Well, it's a win-win-win situation.
Exactly.
Where you're improving the environment, you're making a better future for the planet, but you're also improving quality of life.
Exactly. And I think that's where all the big successes in conservation are going to happen.
Well, and Connie, I know you've been also looking at success stories in Iowa. Here in Iowa, in the media, when we talk about the environment, we do tend to focus on water quality issues or soil loss and not so much on the positive. So let's talk about what you might think of as an Iowa success story.
Well, I'm an ecologist by training, even though I write about other subjects sometimes. But I think that the whole idea of restoration ecology is huge in Iowa. Iowa is perhaps the most, if not or the first or second most, disturbed, transformed state in the Union. And perhaps because of that, we've got a passionate and dedicated Iowans who are working to restore and preserve the natural features of Iowa's land. And these stem everywhere where, well, they are applying restoration, which means bringing native species and native integrity and ecosystem services back to the land. Those are all, of course, destroyed when you plow something up for cropland. But people who are trying to bring these native features back, these gifts of the land back to Iowa, are applying that in public lands, private organizations like the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, a number of private land owners, some of whom are taking big plots of land, a square mile of Iowa, like at Timber Hill or Indian Grass Hills, and bringing back natural integrity. Our local land trust has preserved about 700 acres here in Johnson County. That's mostly in recent years. And all of these people are either rebuilding ecosystems on the land or finding remnants of nature on the land and fostering them. And they're even applying the skills to restoration, the restoration skills to our croplands now, and trying to integrate native species into croplands for the benefit both of the croplands and of nature. These native strips, the STRIPS program, which is being developed at Iowa State University. They're finding that integrating just strips of native species on about 10% of the cropland will reduce soil loss from that cropland by 95%. And nitrate runoff, which is causing a lot of the water pollution in Iowa, by 70%. And in addition to having these very obvious benefits, those strips of native species are providing habitat and flood mitigation, as well as stopping soil erosion.
So, and when you drive around rural areas, you see these in many, many fields. I mean, this is a program that has grown dramatically over the last decade or so.
Well, I think that the STRIPS program itself is fairly new, and it's being applied. I think there are a few hundreds farms in Iowa now, but the idea of bringing back buffer strips is certainly being applied across the state and is very important. But one of the things that I like about all of the restoration is the way it gets people out on the land. So there are the benefits of training students and also exposing students to nature. So, for example, our colleges, Luther College and Grinnell College, both have extensive lands that they are preserving and managing and restoring. And they get the students out on the land through crops, through classes, through volunteer work, to experience what restoration ecology is like. Drake University, Professor Tom Rosberg at Drake University, has something called the Weekend Warriors, where he takes students out to restore private lands. And I think that one of the things I love about being here in Iowa is that there are a lot of creative programs that are being developed for reuniting people not only with nature in general, but with restoring nature. And these are programs that are applied to volunteers of all ages. Some people in their 70s and 80s are very active in restoring the land.
I want to bring some of our callers into the conversation now. We're talking about earth optimism this hour. Bob is on the line from Muscatine. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, hi. I have two comments and a question for Connie. I think anybody who hasn't, if anybody wants to read a good book on Iowa ecology, they should read Emerald Horizon. And if they want to read a second good book, they should read it twice. It's very, very good. I'm very positive on the diversity that I'm seeing over the last 60 years I've lived on Wyoming Hill by Muscatine. It's expanded a great deal. At first, 60 years ago, we saw groundhogs and squirrels, and that was about it. And last year, I found my first bobcat in a camera picture. And I also found what in Connie's book shouldn't even be here in Iowa, and that was a eastern box turtle. The bad news is that the timber, as far as diversity and number of trees, is slowly going backwards. We're losing, and I wanted to ask Connie if she saw that turning around anytime soon, since she dedicated a lot of her book talking about the problems of forest lands in Iowa.
Yeah, Bob, thanks so much for your question. We do have a lot of different problems affecting tree species in Iowa right now. It's easy to focus on the gloom and doom there as well. Connie, timber in Iowa.
Yeah, hi, Bob. Thanks for that positive word about Emerald Horizon. But tree savanna restoration, woodland restoration, is becoming more and more active in Iowa. And indeed, if people don't manage the lands, our wonderful oak hickory woodlands that dominated the land, oaks covered 80% of Iowa when Iowa was first being settled, didn't cover 80% of Iowa, excuse me. Oaks constituted 80% of all of the trees in Iowa in the 1800s, early 1800s. And those we're losing those oaks if we don't act to manage the lands by fire and other techniques, for sure. So we can do that. But people are doing it successfully. If you want to see a good example, I would encourage you to visit Timber Hill down in southeastern Iowa sometime. An incredible savanna restoration, probably one of the best in the nation. My husband and I are restoring our little 16-acre plot, and you're welcome to come and visit it sometime. I'd love to show you around, but what you see there is oaks starting to, just barely starting to reproduce, which is what we need, and also an incredible diversity of understory species that we hadn't seen previously. So we do know how to restore woodlands, and if we don't, we're going to lose them. We're going to lose the high-quality ones.
So you can look again at small projects that people have done that give you hope?
Small and large. Oh, definitely. Small and large as well. Yeah.
Bob, thank you so much for your call. You're welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And you can send us email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll get back to the phones after a short break. Connie, I know that you have talked to a lot of students about finding hope, making sure that they can maintain their motivation. What's just one piece of advice for people that you would give them if they're feeling hopeless?
Well, I guess since I'm a real nature lover, I would say go out and take a walk in the natural world. One of the things that restores hope to me is just being out and seeing nature's incredible ability to respond to our slightest efforts for restoration and respond with both beauty and with resilience and ecosystem services and the like.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Connie Mutel is here with me. Her most recent book is A Sugar Creek Chronicle, Observing Climate Change in a Midwestern Woodland. Bob was just plugging an older book of hers, The Emerald Horizon, The History of Nature in Iowa. Also with us, Nancy Knowlton, Chair of Marine Science at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian. We're talking about an environmental movement called Earth Optimism this hour. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about a relatively new environmental movement. It's called Earth Optimism. Instead of focusing on the gloom and doom, the terrible things that are happening on our planet, they're focusing on the positives, the change that people have been able to make, and painting a vision for a brighter future, empowering environmentalists and scientists with the idea that they can make a difference. All of us can make a difference. With me is one of the leaders of the movement, Nancy Knowlton, Chair of Marine Science at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian. Connie Mutel is here as well, author and a senior science writer at the University of Iowa. And I want to talk about energy for a few minutes, Nancy, as we're talking about positive stories, things that have really made a lot of change. And we touched on this a little bit earlier, but we have a situation with renewable energy where it's making so much economic sense right now that it's really moving outside of the realm of politics.
That's right. I mean, it isn't, or it shouldn't be, a red state, blue state kind of situation with respect to renewable energy, because it's now in most parts of the world, renewable energy is actually cost competitive and often cheaper than energy based on fossil fuel. So it's really a question of making that transition both fast enough and humanely enough. And one of the examples I like to talk about in terms of this issue is a program that again was featured in at the Earth Optimism Summit. It's a project called the Coalfield Development Corporation, and it's run by a person who is a born and bred person from West Virginia, and what he does is work on training people who are being displaced by the decline in coal, and largely at this point, because of the improvement of natural gas, but also renewable energies as well. And he retrains them. He gives them. He and his group provide education and job opportunities for things like green construction, sustainable agriculture, renewable energy installations, and restoration of the landscapes that have been damaged by mining. And this is really important because, there was an article that came out a couple of months ago about saying that, this isn't a big problem because, after all, Arby's employs more people than the coal mining industry. And to me, that actually totally misses the point, which is that the people who are, working in the coal industry, that the coal is going to disappear because of all these economic processes that are taking place, but those people have kids, they have mortgages to pay, they have doctor's bills to pay, and it's really important for this this journey to sustainability be one that everyone feels that they can be part of and be happy to be part of. And so I really think it's not only that it's economically inevitable, but it's really important to be socially inclusive.
Connie, let's talk about energy in Iowa. Of course, anybody who drives across the state of Iowa knows that wind energy has grown dramatically in the state. There's also a strong movement in solar energy as well. Tell me what we're seeing in the energy industry here.
Yeah, and Iowa is certainly a good example of that transformation that Nancy mentioned. And I want to emphasize what you said, Nancy. We're going to get to a renewable energy society, to a carbon neutral society. The question is just how fast do we move? And we need to make sure we get there before we get all sorts of tipping points happening with climate change processes. But in any case, in Iowa, 37%, a little bit over a third of the energy produced in Iowa is now generated from wind. And that number goes up, I think, pretty much every year. The people working on those wind energy turbines, 7,000 jobs here in Iowa, a big factor. And solar is becoming bigger in part because of a very wise state tax rebate that's, I think, also matched by a federal tax rebate. 1,500 jobs across the state involved in installing and maintaining those solar panels. So these are big things. Iowa's a small state, but these are big job sources that are affecting the rural areas and bringing hope to rural areas as well as cities.
Now, let's get back to the phones. Wilbur in Sioux City has some concerns about the idea of Earth optimism. Hi, Wilbur.
Good morning.
What's your concern?
I hate to, excuse the expression, throw cold water on what you're saying, but I've been driving back and forth to Minneapolis a lot lately. And you obviously aren't driving around Northwest Iowa because I haven't seen one watershed. We virtually have no trees, and we've got a manure spill and a fish kill almost every other day. Sioux County stinks to high heaven, and so it kind of grates me that you're minimalizing the problem we have in this state. I appreciate what you're doing and what you're saying, but believe me, up here and where we live, it's in a lot worse shape than people believe. And with politicians being paid off by Iowa Corn Growers Association and the soybean folks and the Farm Bureau and stuff, I just don't know how the serious changes are coming about. You know, Bill Norby is going to be on the agricultural department, and he's a farmer that's been polluting the land for years. So, I wish it were true what you were saying, but I think we've got quite a ways to go.
Yeah, Wilbur.
How you're framing it.
Thank you so much for bringing that up, because I think I'm going to go to you first, Nancy, although you weren't talking specifically about Iowa, but I'm sure you hear this a lot. As we've said, there is so much that is going wrong and has gone wrong. The problems are very real. So I'm sure you hear often people saying, you know, focusing on these positives is just glossing over this terrible, terrible problem.
I do hear that kind of comment, and it's a perfectly understandable response. It's just that I think that talking only about the problems, I mean, it's not just I think. Social scientists have known for decades, actually, if you present people with really big problems and no solutions, that they don't become motivated to do anything. They don't go into action. They become apathetic, because what's the point of worrying about a problem that you can't do anything about? So really, the argument about Earth optimism is not that we're trying to gloss over the magnitude of the problem. It's more we're trying to make people recognize that there actually are not only possible solutions, but things that are going in the right direction right now, so that people can learn from those examples of success and be inspired by them, maybe take actions themselves. So it's not to minimize the scale and the scope of the threat, but it's more that these solutions are not getting a fair shake in terms of the attention they receive. I mean, to give you one specific example, in Tampa Bay, it was a situation where nutrient pollution had decimated the water quality. So that by the 60s and 70s, there were no seagrasses, that sort of underwater version of Iowa on land, no seagrasses under the water. And that's really bad for a variety of reasons. And the people in Tampa decided to take action. They passed rules. They cleaned up the water. And in 2015, it was announced that the seagrass beds had returned to 1950s levels. Now, that's an incredible success. But when I go around the country talking about what is working to provide some balance, almost nobody knows about it. I once talked about this at a meeting of Gulf of Mexico scientists that was taking place in Tampa, 200 people in the room. Only four people raised their hand when I asked them who knew about this. So we've got to at least talk about and be cognizant of the successes that are there in order to have more successes be possible.
Well, and Wilbur's not just asking about maybe the what he sees as a problem of focusing on the positive, but he's also talking about problems that, again, he sees, and there are many people in Iowa who also see these problems, but there are other people who want to deny that they are there. So, again, we have a situation that's somewhat similar to climate change. Connie, would you like to respond to what Wilbur was saying?
I just want to say amen to everything that Nancy said. I think she was right on. And Wilbur, neither Nancy nor I nor others are denying that Iowa's water quality is huge and it's not being adequately redressed, and that we need a lot more of all of the good things going on, that the examples that we gave already. But I like to say you never put somebody into a room without giving them a door to come out. And I think what Nancy is saying is when you put people into the room of all of the problems like you're dealing with up there in northwestern Iowa, if you can manage somehow to consider some sort of a door to get out, sometimes people say, what can I do? What can I do? I say, start with planting one prairie species, one native species. And watch what happens. Pretty soon you'll see insects that you had never seen before, and you're going to be hooked and just take it from there. I mean, it's a way of thinking, hopefully, instead of with despair, I guess.
Let's go back to the phones. Bill is on the line in Sac City. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Charity, and thank you for taking my call. One of the opportunities that we have in Iowa for positive transformation is the rescuing of many of the prairie remnants that are already in public ownership. And those are the many bike trails that are old railroad right-of-ways. They have a seed bank and native species in there. But what happens is that these trails are overcome by trees, and they're never removed. And finally, the trees eventually just crowd out all the native species and the seed bank. And by removing the trees and doing some controlled burns would do a great deal to restore the native prairie remnants that we already have, but we're just not taking care of them. And there are some old cemeteries that have those prairie remnants as well that could be addressed in the same way.
And Bill, I know this is work you've been involved in, right?
It is, and that's one of my true loves is native prairies and remnants as well.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for bringing that up. Connie?
Go for it, Bill. I think it's great. You're exactly right. We need to manage the remnants, not just preserve them.
And speaking of things that are working in Iowa, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about some of the work that the Tallgrass Prairie Center has been doing.
Right. I think this is a good example of Iowa's creativity and collegiality, people working together. So the Tallgrass Prairie Center is at the University of Northern Iowa. It's the center that started to plant Iowa's roadsides and native species. Of the 750,000 acres of Iowa roadsides, about 50,000 of those acres are now planted in native species, and I believe most of those are managed. This is an example for the nation. No other state has something similar. And another thing that I just learned about was the fact that the Tallgrass Prairie Center is now has developed a pollinator habitat seed list and is producing seeds that can be planted on CRP land to enhance the land and bring back pollinators, which we know is a huge problem. And in the last 2 years, 220,000 acres have been planted in Iowa in pollinator habitat. So to me, that is a tremendous sign of hope and hopefully resilience for the future.
Here's a question from Cindy in Ames. She says, do you think there's a potential problem of the optimism movement being joined by optimism that's based on dubious data and logic? Recently, I've heard claims that high nitrate levels in drinking water really aren't so bad, that the sage grouse is doing better than most researchers claim, the exotic species invasion should just be accepted as a new kind of nature, et cetera. Nancy, is there a danger there?
Yes, of course. And that's why it's important to take every one of these successes and think about it objectively. It's not supposed to be just a feel-good story. It's supposed to be a documented real success. And so each one of these, when I talk about successes, and I'm sure when Connie does the same thing, we choose successes where there's information, there's data that's supporting that it is a genuine success. Because, no, we don't want to flood the airwaves with false examples of greenwashing, things that aren't really doing any good, that just seem good. That's not the point. But there are a lot of successes out there that are genuine successes that are very poorly known. And so that's really what we're trying to shine a spotlight on.
Now, Earth Optimism is a relatively new movement. As we talked about earlier, you held your first summit last spring. This approach, have you been able to see positive change that you think is a result of Earth Optimism?
You know, it's a tricky thing to measure, like all these sort of social movement kinds of things. But it's definitely the case that, for example, in meetings among people who work on conservation, either broadly or marine conservation, there are now examples of whole sessions being devoted to successes, whereas that never used to happen before. So I think the professional community is actually coming around to the recognition that it's really important to talk about not only the problems, which we should talk about, but also what's working and how to make more of that kind of success. And so you're seeing a change in the professional community. You're also seeing, for example, there's a book that was just published called Drawdown, which is 100 examples of the energy solutions that are being implemented around the world. There are a number of other books that are being published. So I think what we're starting to see is a recognition by a variety of people working in the field that there are these successes out there, talking about them, and then people respond. I get emails from people all the time telling me that they're going to go off and do something because they were inspired by this message that we actually can do something and it's not hopeless. So it's hard to measure, especially when you think about it. I mean, the Earth Optimism Summit only happened a little over 6 months
right.
ago. But on Twitter, on social media, and just in terms of personal interactions, And the way meetings among professionals are being structured, there are changes afoot.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Nancy Knowlton is chair of marine science at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian. She's also one of the leaders of the movement called Earth Optimism, focusing on success stories, change that can be accomplished and has been accomplished through environmental action. Connie Mutel, thank you for being here today.
My pleasure.
Connie Mutel, her most recent book is A Sugar Creek Chronicle, Observing Climate Change from a Midwestern Woodland. She's a senior science writer with Hydroscience and Engineering at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. The program is produced by Lindsay Moon, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. You can get in touch with us anytime. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbie.